Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the increasingly key role West Virginia Senator Manchin is playing in controlling Biden's agenda, and look into what motivates Manchin's stance as he announced his opposition to Biden's corporate tax raise to pay for infrastructure, and vowed that there was, quote, no circumstances in which I will vote to eliminate or weaken the filibuster. Anne-Marie Lafazo, a professor of law at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, jurisprudence, and comparative labor law, joins us to discuss how Manchin could learn from his mentor, Senator Byrd, who lavished the state with pork. With West Virginia the 50th state in the country in terms of underinvestment in infrastructure, we will also discuss how much infrastructure could help Manchin, but with Sinclair Broadcasting brainwashing the population with Stop the Steal lies, the overwhelming majority who voted for Trump don't see Biden as a legitimate president, so as a Democrat, Manchin does not have much room to maneuver in this poor white evangelical and gun-toting state. Then we'll examine President Biden's executive orders announced today to curb what he described as an epidemic of gun violence, which he called an international embarrassment. Biden proposed adding serial numbers to the components in kits from which untraceable ghost guns can be assembled, and issued guidance for red flag laws that allow for intervention to, quote, stop mass shooters before they act out their violent plans. But he made clear that a lot more needs to be done by Congress to strengthen background checks, ban assault rifles, and strip immunity from gun manufacturers. Joining us is Patrick Blanchfield, a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, who has written extensively about gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control, and is the author of the forthcoming book Gun Power, The System of American Violence. We'll discuss Biden's modest attempts at gun safety and how the important, much-needed reforms could be achieved. Then finally, we'll speak with Dr. Andrew Hartman, a professor of history at Illinois State University, who is the founding president of the Society of U.S. Intellectual History and the author of A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. He joins us to discuss how the Republicans, absent a party platform and agenda, are invested in feeding the outraged machine of right-wing media to distract their base from how their representatives no longer serve the people, but are servants of the oligarchy. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Anne-Marie Lafazo, who's a professor of law at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, jurisprudence, and comparative labor law. Dr. Lafazo spent 10 years as an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board's appellate and Supreme Court branches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anne-Marie Lafazo.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you're there in West Virginia, and I'm hoping to get a kind of handle on who Joe Manchin is, because he has an extraordinary amount of power. In fact, he has the power to either enable the Biden agenda or sabotage it or cripple it. And on Monday on a West Virginia radio talk show, he said in terms of the second Biden's $2.25 trillion infrastructure proposal that as the bill exists today, it needs to be changed. And its current corporate tax rate, of course, is 21% under Trump's tax cuts for the rich in 2017. Manchin is saying that the 28% that Biden's calling for is too much, and that 25% is what he would call fair. And then on Wednesday, in an op-ed in the Washington Post, he said, Manchin, there are no circumstances in which I will vote to eliminate or weaken the filibuster, going on to say, if the filibuster is eliminated or budget reconciliation becomes the norm, a new and dangerous precedent will be set to pass sweeping partisan legislation that changes the direction of our nation every time there is a change in political control. The consequences will be profound. Our nation may never see stable government governing again. So those are pretty lofty notions, but where does this come from? I mean, he is a Democrat, and we've known now with the filibuster in place that basically you just can email your objection in, and there's no way in the world you'll get anything, a 60 votes. You won't peel off 10 Republicans. The seventh most liberal Republican is Mitch McConnell. So there seems to be a disconnect between Manchin's lofty ideas of how, indeed, we should have a more functioning government and the fact that we don't have a functioning government, and it's largely because the Republicans are playing hardball.
Right, that's definitely correct. I think to understand Manchin, you have to understand West Virginia and what its role is in the United States and who the people are. So West Virginia is the only state in the country that is entirely in Appalachia. All 55 counties are in Appalachia. It is a poor majority white state with very few immigrants. It is number 50th in infrastructure, which by that I mean not just roads, but also internet. Is very bad internet, and we found that out the hard way at the law school when even our own students during the pandemic, when they were at home in parts of West Virginia, it was really hard for them to connect, which is unheard of in a place like New York, for example, where I'm originally from. We have tremendous drug problems, the opioid crisis. You have monopsony jobs, so monopsony employers predominantly in the energy industry. You have a gun culture, primarily because of hunting, and that oftentimes because people are not very wealthy, that's how they get their meat, their protein during the winter, is by hunting. You have an evangelical Christian, socially conservative culture that is very anti-abortion, but you also have a libertarian culture that is at best neutral on government, but is very suspicious of government. Because government has, as you can see, has done very little to help West Virginia, except for what Byrd has been able to get for us. So you have, for example, take infrastructure. Schools have been consolidated, and kids are bused sometimes over an hour each way to commute to school each day on very small little roads. So instead of investing in teachers, you're investing in gasoline. And you have a relatively, not a particularly high marriage rate, and you have what you would see sort of I can say that a lot of my students have children, and a lot of my students, their family members will have children with different, let's say blended families, where not necessarily the people are married. Well, what does this sound like? It sounds like almost the same exact problems that you would have in the inner cities, except substitute that it's not a majority white culture, it's a more diverse, racially diverse culture in the cities. But you have also, all right, what's your infrastructure problem there? It's not necessarily the internet, but it's access to good schools. What do you have? A drug problem? Yep. It may not be opioids, it might be, but it's other things as well. You don't have the monopsony job problem that we have, but you have job problems in the sense that there's not good jobs for people that are in poverty. So because they can't get good education because they don't have access to good educational systems. And, okay, then take guns. There's a problem with guns, but it's a different type of problem where I like to tell my students when I'm trying to explain why people in the East Coast and the West Coast really want more gun control, I explain, look, if you have a gun in New York, if you have a gun in West Virginia, you're going hunting. If you have a gun in New York, you're hunting for people, not for deer. And so it is a there is a the gun culture is very different in the inner cities, and that creates a tension between the way people in West Virginia see guns, which is as part of their ability to eat in the winter, and the way people on the coasts see guns, where we don't have, thank God, mass murders. So now in comes Joe Manchin, who is from Fairmont, which is a pretty close city to where I'm from in Morgantown, and he understands this, obviously. And he also, so we've switched from a Democratic to a Republican state. He's pretty much the only major Democratic leader left. And you have a state that that Sinclair owns 50% of the market share in the Wheeling market and 40% of the market share in the Charleston-Huntington market. Okay, well, what does that mean? The largest city in West Virginia is Charleston. The second largest is Huntington, then Morgantown and Parkersburg, which I'll explain in a second, and then Wheeling, and then Weirton, which is part of Wheeling, which means the majority of people are getting their news from where? Or a large majority are getting their news from Sinclair and Fox. So there, here, we don't have an immigration problem, so why is everyone worried about immigration in West Virginia? Why is that coming up? Because they're listening to what's going on. Why do people, we voted overwhelmingly for Trump, so why are people worried about the elections? Because they believe in the big lie. If you talk to people, I don't necessarily mean 70% who voted for Trump, but probably this is just a complete guess, but maybe 2/3 of the state believes that Joe Biden was not elected fairly. And it doesn't matter what you tell them and ask them for facts, they'll tell you, this is my opinion, I'm entitled to my opinion. And this is why we need to change the elections. So and this is the last thing I think is really important. If you have a majority white state, so you don't have a lot of interracial friction. Of course, we have our racial issues, but it's relatively low compared to, say, someplace in the South where there's a lot of, it's a much larger population of people of color. But they see that they have the same exact problems that, say, poor people of color have, but no one's paying attention to them. So from their point of view, they've just been ignored and forgotten by the government. So they're going to just listen to anyone that will feed into that grievance. And that's what's going on. And Joe Manchin understands this, which means he's got a problem with those people if he doesn't make them happy. He knows he doesn't really have a major problem getting primaried because the Democrats here have figured out that they're not going to be able to win an election Joe Manchin's the most electable Democrat. So the only way he gets primaried, if the Democrats just say in West Virginia, just say, you know what, we know we're going to lose anyway, but Manchin is not really someone who is helping us. So we're just going to do it. We know we're losing, but we lose anyway if we get Manchin. So unlikely that Democrats will do that as long as Manchin sort of toes the line close enough. And instead, he's got to make sure he wins the election against a Republican, which means he's got to make those people with the grievance happy. And they are believing the big lie. And that's the problem. And that's why, if you can understand that, if you want to read, Hillbilly Elegy and other things, you're not going to get an accurate description of what's going on here. What you have to do is understand what I live with every single day in talking with my students and understanding, and what I've been doing for 15 years is understanding. So I understand being a native New Yorker who also lived 10 years in Washington, D.C., who's lived in New England, who's lived in Europe also, and now has lived 15 years in West Virginia. And I think I get the different cultures. And if you don't, you can just, you're just stereotyping that, oh, West Virginians are XYZ, and you're not dignifying them in understanding what their real grievance is. And until if I were Manchin, what I would do, and he is very powerful, I would go for that infrastructure and say, okay, you want to make West Virginians happy? This is what you do. Joe Biden, give us infrastructure. We're number 50th in the country. Why are we so low in infrastructure? Well, one, we're all mountainous. Do you know how much more expensive it is to build a road in Appalachia than it is anywhere else in the country? It's, I think, and you should check me on this, but this is just like a round number, like 9 times more expensive. So,
but
yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to just mention that Bobby Byrd, who was the Democratic, long-serving Democratic senator from West Virginia, who is Manchin's mentor in many ways,
right,
he was famous for ladling pork on the state. So why then is Manchin against this infrastructure bill when that would be the best thing he could do?
Oh, I agree with that. I think he is very concerned about, he hasn't won the people over. What he should do, if I were him, is go into West Virginia and talk to them and explain, I'm going to get you these roads, I'm going to get this for you. And I actually think that Joe Biden isn't as toxic as Obama or Hillary Clinton were in this state. So he might be able to get enough votes. Right now, Joe Biden isn't completely toxic. But he's getting there. And not for anything that Joe Biden's doing, but what the messages that are being given out.
You mean Sinclair?
Sinclair, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And Fox, yeah. So when the one thing that Manchin did say in his op-ed at the Washington Post on Wednesday was that Republicans, however, have a responsibility to stop saying no and participate in finding real compromise with Democrats. Is there any Republican that Joe Manchin can win over?
You mean a Republican in Congress?
In the Senate, yeah. In other words,
in the Senate, yeah.
If you could get a Republican, then you could have at least the fig leaf of bipartisanship and then maybe go ahead and do some of these things like pass SB1, which if you don't pass SB1, the Democrats are finished because the Republicans are going to gerrymander and steal the vote. They're already underway.
He might be able to get Susan Collins or the Republican from Alaska, whose name is escaping me right now.
Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, exactly. Murkowski. I mean, obviously, there's a few moderate Republicans that I think he can win over. I don't think he can really win over Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, I think, has a lot of integrity, but I think he's fairly conservative on these issues. So he's not, I don't think Mitt Romney is really in play, really. But I think he could get one of the other two senators, possibly, who I think he tends to be more like them. In fact, I think Susan Collins is probably more liberal than Joe Manchin. So I agree with him. I think he's trying to sound reasonable, that he's really in the middle and he's playing this. I think that he would go with certain budget reconciliation. And I think I hope what he's doing for the sake of my state, which has been neglected, I hope he is just trying to hold out for some pork. Because the students are on, you cannot travel through the state without going through little roads. And it's really, I agree with Joe Biden, infrastructure is so important. We don't have high-speed rail. Do you know what it would do to our state to have high-speed rail between here and D.C. or here in Pittsburgh? It would completely transform the state because there would no longer be monopsony power. Completely transform it. And it would be a completely different, it would be a whole new ballpark. I'll tell you something else. Look at Morgantown. Morgantown is 70 miles from Pittsburgh. And it doesn't have a Sinclair news affiliate. We get our news from Pittsburgh. And notice, we often vote liberal. We're very middle, and we're right, like 50-50. So why is, you could say, well, it's a university town, right? It is, but there's also the majority of people are not the professors. It's still right. There's still rural parts of the county.
Right, and they're not being voting. Right, they're not being brainwashed by Sinclair. But so
right.
Just in the last couple of minutes, though, just give me a sense of Manchin's state of mind, because he's obviously getting a lot of liberals really hate him, you know, and now you see on MSNBC some of the pundits referring to him as President Manchin, as though he's usurping the presidency of Joe Biden. Is there a danger that he will get annoyed with this liberal criticism and walk across the aisle and make Mitch McConnell the majority leader of the Senate, and then it'll be all over for Biden?
Yes. And the reason I say that is because he has to appease, like all politicians, they care about the next election. So he has to care about that 70% who voted for Trump. And remember, the person who is alleged to have killed the police officer on the insurrection day came from West Virginia. Remember that there is, in other words, there were West Virginians who went to that insurrection and really believed they were doing the right thing. So he's got to appease a group of people that believe the Democrats it's a coup d'etat. So is he going to be pushed so hard by the Democratic Party that he just says, look, I need to live another day, so I'm going to switch over to the Republicans? That's what Jim Justice did. Jim Justice got in as a Democrat, our governor, and now he's a Republican, and he's popular. And he's also popular because he's done a really good job with COVID, unlike a lot of governors. He's actually doing a really good job. But that's what Manchin sees, that's a model for Manchin. So the West Virginia Democrats have not pushed that because we know that Manchin is a moderate, and a left-wing Democrat is not going to win in the state. So yes, I think that is a very big danger. I also think it's a little unfair to say President Manchin, because it's then saying that the president should be the, it's a value judgment that the president should be the most powerful person in the government, when actually Congress should be the most powerful entity. It's Article 1, and that there needs to be checks on the president. Yes, I agree with, I like Biden. I voted for Biden. I was with Biden from the beginning, so because I thought he could heal the nation. But I also think just in general that one person being in control is dangerous. So checks should be on the president. But the problem is that our Congress is not functioning because it's really not listening to the people. If it were listening to the people, we wouldn't have this fight about Obamacare, because 70-80% of the people like having health care, right? It's popular. Just don't call it Obamacare. Call it the ACA. It's popular. Right. So, unfortunately, they're listening to their donors with a lot of money rather than actually engaging in democracy, representative democracy. And
well,
that's another problem.
Well, Anne, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Anne Marie LaFaza, who's a professor of law at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, jurisprudence, and comparative labor law. And Dr. LaFaza spent 10 years as an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board's appellate and Supreme Court branches. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining President Biden's executive orders announced today to curb what he described as an epidemic of gun violence, which he called an international embarrassment.
I searched the land below, looking for that love of mine left 20 long years ago. Her love I took in vain, her love I did not earn, love is something that you might find.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Patrick Blanfield, who's a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His writing on gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Book Forum, Dissent, and N+1. And his new book, Gun Power, The System of American Violence, will be out from Verso Books later this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Blanchfield.
Hello, Ian. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today, President Biden offered some modest steps to address what he describes as an epidemic of gun violence in this country. Going on to say, gun violence in this country is an epidemic and it's an international embarrassment. But he also, of course, said that the real work needs to be done by the Congress. That is to close background check loopholes, ban assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, and strip gun manufacturers of protections from lawsuit. So in terms of what he achieved today or what he's proposing today, give us an assessment of what these two modest proposals with ghost guns and with red flag laws, what will they achieve?
Well, so there are four or five things, of which those I think are probably the most salient, right? But here, I'll just break them down all for you. And I should say just, yeah, it's like the framing of this as an epidemic is really striking, right? Because it sort of implies that it's like this out of control calling thing that's like ravaging the U.S. much in the same way as, you know, that other epidemic COVID is. And I think what's sort of a helpful corrective or way to think about gun violence without in any way gainsaying its horror is to view it as more of an endemic situation, right? It's a thing, it's an ongoing, very familiar, differentially distributed thing, right? That's part of how normal in this country is constituted, right? So and when we talk about going back to normal, like that normalcy involves a lot of gun violence in a variety of different modes, right? Whether it be suicide or retaliatory violence amongst impoverished youth in various inner city or similar situations. It involves in partner murder, right? Largely men killing women and children. It involves mass shootings, which are only public high profile mass shootings, which are the immediate impetus for this set of interventions. And it involves suicide and police shootings as well, right? So it's a multi-form problem, and any response to it, I think, needs to pay full attention to the full scope and unique dimensions of it. In terms of how these things stack out with it, I think the thing to really pay attention to here is I'll just front how I'm feeling about it. I'm unsurprised by anything in this. I think people who are familiar with Joe Biden's record or are old enough to have recalled sort of his various stances going back to the 70s, but also crucially in the 90s when the crime bill and the assault weapons ban were sort of key Joe Biden deliverables, should be not surprised by any of this, right? A series of high-profile events happen. There's call for gun control of some sort, though it's not exactly clear what that means. And then against the backdrop of deadlocked or difficult legislative bargaining, first, we have a series of executive actions, right, and that, which are fairly minor in scope, and then ultimately some sort of tinkering around the edges that deals with certain specific, like, technical matters and also is ultimately about institutionally reinforcing the power of law enforcement. So that's, like, the constant theme. And the theme is always, here's the new type of gun that is very bad, right? Something happens. An event happens, generally targeting vulnerable people, right? But then it becomes an iteration of, well, actually what we should focus on is a new set of guns that are very bad, right? Whether it's, and you take this back to the frontier, and in my book I do, you can take it back to the 30s. It's a perennial thing, but with Joe Biden specifically, it's, here is a new set of guns that are bad, right? They're Soviet Saturday, they're Russian manufactured Saturday night special pistols, or it's assault weapons, or it's ghost guns. But it's striking that he leads with this, right, today in particular, because ghost guns are they're not really that much of a problem, but I think, or rather they're compared to any of these other sort of structural problems, such that, but the fact that he begins with that is, I think, a real tell that this is more of Joe Biden has promised, right? So specifically, what ghost guns are, for your listeners who may be curious about these things, like, it's a term for, without getting too, like, inside baseball, so to speak, on this, you can take a variety of pieces of metal that have been machined up to the point, or plastic or whatnot, that have been machined up to a certain level where they are essentially like the raw basis for what could become a firearm, but are not legally guns themselves, right? So essentially it's like an $800 paperweight in the shape of a lower receiver of an AR-15. And then you, with a series of tools, a Dremel, a machine, it's not an easy thing to do, though, you know, it's gotten easier with the advent of 3D printing, etc., can tweak it down such that you then turn this hunk of aluminum or plastic or whatever into part of a broader assembly of modules, which then becomes a gun, legally speaking. And in terms of the legal status of that, I mean, I think it should be significant, the fact that, you know, federally speaking, and on most states, for the vaster majority of American history, it's been entirely legal for people to make their own guns, at least on the state level, and certainly on the federal one, right? As long as you don't sell them, right? Because the key thing, the reason why they're called ghost guns, is because they don't have a serial number, right, inscribed, because you're not like Colt manufacturing, you're some guy in your garage, right? And by the way, I should say that this has been existing for a long time. There's a particularly since the Vietnam War, there's been a prominent gun culture built around people making their own parts, like in their own specifically like interest in AR-15s, right? So like the effort here is to regulate that in some way. But like, again, the truth of the matter is that like they're not that actually. I think, again, I'm not gainsaying the horror of gun violence more broadly, or the horror of violence done with you know, assault rifles or anything else like that. They're not very frequently used in murders, mass or otherwise. There have been a couple cases in California, but also like this is not the primary drive. This is not a key ingredient in America's gun violence, quote unquote, epidemic. Right?
It's just but Biden, yeah, more or less said that. I mean, yeah, that the real heavy lifting has to be done by the Congress. But you still have, in this country, on an average day in the United States, more than 100 people are killed by guns. There are 393 million guns in this country, according to a 2018 Small Arms Survey. Yeah. And that there's more than one gun per American, and about 46% of all civilian-owned firearms in the world. And this high level of gun ownership clearly has a lot to do why we have so much gun violence. But in terms of politics, California and New York, for example, the first and the fourth largest states, they favor stricter gun control laws, but they comprise about 18% of the population of the United States, but only 4% of the senators.
Yeah.
So that's the problem, isn't it? You've got these red states and these rural states that have a whole different attitude towards guns and a different experience. You know, in West Virginia, people hunt for food. In New York, they hunt each other. People.
Well, I mean, I think this is the key thing here, right? Is even less the America's idiosyncratic federalist system and the weird way certain powers are devolved to the states. And I should say, by the way, right, in addition to some other technical stuff vis-a-vis what are called stabilizing braces, which are another sort of, we don't even need to get into.
Well, that was used in the Colorado shooting there.
Yes.
And that's why there were no wounded, by the way, in that shooting. Yeah. So whatever that brace is, it seems like it was able to mean that people were shot dead as opposed to wounded.
Yeah. I mean, I'm struck by the fact that on the Biden situation here, like with this one, like the injunction is for the ATF to look into possibly regulating these things, whereas Donald Trump, when there was that the Vegas shooting, was like, "Oh, we're going to ban bump stocks," and they did, right? There's something oddly tentative in the Biden approach here, but yeah, like again, this is but stabilizing braces are like basically you can, much in the same way as that hunk of steel or aluminum is not a gun until you do certain things to it. The legal definition of the distinction between a pistol and rifle is somewhat technical, and basically a stabilizing brace is, just for layman's purposes, it's a way of transporting certain features from a rifle to a pistol-sized platform. But it gets very technical. It's something like how you hold it. It doesn't even really matter. In some ways, like the point here that I'm getting at is that like the regulatory systems here are always playing catch-up. And the through lines, though, are, as you allude to, like, are about the way in which violence is actually distributed in this country between different populations, right? And the through lines of essentially state control for attempting to mitigate, preempt, or punish that, oftentimes through yet more violence, right? And so it's, this is, so what's striking here too about the, again, why there's so little that's new in the Biden program, such as it is, right, is that apart from, you know, trying to sub in a new guy to a former ATF person and refill the ATF, give it a head, it hasn't had one in 5 or 6 years, and pushing for, you know, some new increased research on gun violence statistics, which sounds good enough to me, but there is this turn, essentially, like a lot of, one thing that's a major feature is support for what are being called community gun violence initiatives, which is kind of a catch-all, but again, is basically a lot of money being spread through 5 or 6 different institutions under the federal government, and that's being dispersed towards a variety of ends, of which the ones that are the most striking, and there are some grassroots community stuff that are there, but the ones that are most striking is it's basically a reprise of what happened in the 94 crime bill, right? It's going to be more training for what's called community policing, which really can mean anything. It's more money to hire more police. It's more money for urban surveillance, et cetera, right? So it's not a root cause approach, right? There is some more like community organizations that are getting help for it, but in some ways, actually, the community organizations that are most effective at dealing with gun violence are in some ways the most fragile and have the most tenuous relationship with law enforcement, right? But I don't know. The other thing that strikes me about this entire situation is that the red flag laws, which he did not lead with, right? And the red flag laws are essentially the ability, laws that would allow courts, judges to temporarily seize or restrain or otherwise put guardrails around the ability of a given individual to own a gun as they come into, you know, for a domestic violence hearing, et cetera. That's widely supported by the American populace. There's a wide range of support for that. But again, that's not what he led with. He led with the ghost guns. The discourse is going to always be about, here are some bad guns. Here are ways in which we can give the police more money. And then sort of secondarily, there's a kind of series of working around the edges around stuff. I mean, it's not root cause. It's reactive fundamentally. And part of that is because he's constrained as president to only act by the executive order situation, right? And by the fact that our legislature is deadlocked and honestly nothing is going to happen in the courts probably for a generation. But that's just how this whole thing is structured. That's the Biden brand.
Well, let me ask you, though, about the title of your new book coming out later this year, Gun Power, The System of American Violence. What do you mean by the system of American violence?
So I am doing a deep structure historical analysis to say that there are a series of basic patterns in how gun violence as a phenomena, but also as like a concept and a social problem, is continually reproduced and protected over the long ambit of American history, and in fact, even prior to sort of the U.S.'s explicit foundation, right? So to be a little more technical about it, I'm thinking about sort of gun power as a system, right, in terms of what's called social reproduction theory. It's a way of conceptualizing how vulnerability and inequality are vulnerability specifically to premature death and violence are transmitted across generations and through populations and geographically, right? And I think that's the type of consciousness that you need to have. So, and there are certain systematic trends to this, right? Much again, like there's very little that's being said now that is radically different, though the vocabulary has changed, from what people said from liberal, hard, tough on crime Biden-esque figures said in the 60s and 70s. And you can roll that back to much of the advocacy in the 30s. And I would argue you can take that back even to like early colonial America as well. And essentially it boils down to the fact that, well, guns are necessary. Guns are always going to be here. Some kinds of gun violence are good or not even like count as violence as all. And the issue is that there are bad guns that are going to get in the hands of bad guys. And the answer to that is always more good guns in the hands of good guys. And that's the system, ultimately. We're constantly doubling down on that. I mean, when it comes to like solutions for these things or like ways of thinking about that, I think you have to think about what are the things that system is trying to protect, right? What are the racialized or class-based or gendered positions of relative power and disposability in that framework. And, you know, like, I'm struck by how, like, even the stuff like some aspects of the most recent stuff that Biden's proposing, which are well and good, right? For example, increasing trauma care in hospitals, right? This is one of these things people don't necessarily think about as like a quote-unquote gun control measure, right? But we do make a material impact on gun fatality deaths, specifically in urban populations, right, by having access to better trauma care, right? So it's a triage, right, harm reduction approach, but it's a thing to do. But it's striking, like, it's not universal health care. It's not public hospitals around the country. It's a type of Band-Aid approach, right? Likewise, it leans very heavily on the private sector. There's a lot of partnership programs, right? And in fact, the guy who Biden is putting up to head the ATF, who may not be confirmed, is a former ATF guy, but also and a veteran of a whole bunch of ATF like SWAT programs, but also worked in the nonprofit traditional gun control sector, like sort of a liberal interest group sector, is also a private sector player and was a major figure in a firm called ShotSpotter, which sells what it calls gun detection systems, which are also a mode of urban surveillance, right? So it's about reasserting and maintaining the prerogatives of certain institutions and making sure that there are, you know, certain populations that remain, their violence is confined within them, or that there's an acceptable level of it, right? And for me, I find that it's why it's so easy to predict this stuff, right, as it keeps happening. And in part of the reason why I'm dragging my heels on revising my book is that, in fact, like, as I ended it, I was going to, like, well, Biden will probably call for an AWB, more funding for the COPS programs for community policing, and he's going to be facing an uphill battle in the legislature. And this is exactly what he's done. So now I need to change my
Well, he'll have an uphill battle getting this guy confirmed, too, by the way.
Yeah, he may not. I think we may not have him be confirmed at all. I mean, the more interesting stuff is happening on the state level, like the red flag law templates that the states are going to have are going to be helpful, right, for people. It's going to produce some interesting outcomes. But, like, the thing I keep coming back to, right, and it sounds so basic, but I think it kind of can't be said enough, because it's what all the technical talk, it's what all the, like, this program and this new thing and this specific type of gun, it's what all that kind of, like, immediately kind of brain foggy diversions combined with the, like, high intensity partisan polarization about gun talk that it sort of does. The basic thing for me is just, like, if we made people's lives less miserable, just across the board, a lot of those different modes of gun violence would probably be less of a problem, right? Like, to break this down very specifically, like, if you look at suicides, right, it's gun suicides, which are overwhelmingly, like, I think we're 4% of the world's population, we're somewhere between 80 and 90% of its gunshot suicides, right, of which I think it's like 80% are white men. If you graph the frequency of suicides, it's once men start hitting middle age and they start facing either bankruptcy, right, or a serious medical diagnosis, which might as well also mean bankruptcy, right? No. And it's like, well, or if you look at, if you talk to, you know, young people who are involved in like, quote unquote, like inner city violence, but like violence between gang members and whatnot, you ask them, what would it mean? What would we have to give you? So, like, you're no longer carrying a gun. Like, well, a job with dignity that kept me employed, right? And it's very interesting insofar as that, like, well, if we made it such that, and you can do this for the other categories of gun violence too, but if we made it such that growing old in this country was not like you're taking your chances between whether your health, your bank account, right, or your ability to pull the gun out of your bedside drawer is going to fail first, we would have less suicides.
Right.
If people didn't have to live in hyper-concentrated, hyper-segregated, hyper-over-policed, criminalized spaces, then they wouldn't feel the need to carry guns in the first place, right? And there's something about that I think gets at this broader point that I'm trying to make with gun power, in the sense that, like, those solutions, namely making healthcare available for people, making mental health care available for people, regardless of whether or not, just too core, it broadly, I'm not saying the mentally ill are responsible for gun violence. I'm saying just, like, give people social ties so they can talk to one another. All right. Making jobs available, making, in short, life less miserable for everyone would affect this problem. And it wouldn't it's not traditionally what's called gun control, but the conversation is always about the guns themselves. And it inevitably tends towards, well, now we just need more people with guns to kick down doors and take these guns from other people. It's a self-perpetuating sort of cycle, and it's really sad.
Well, Patrick Glanchfield, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, It's a pleasure. Good luck.
And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Blanchfield, who's a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His writing on gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Book Forum, Dissent, and N Plus One, and elsewhere. And his new book, Gun Power, The System of American Violence, will be out from Verso Books later this year. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the outrage machine of right-wing media who are stoking the culture wars to distract from the fact that the Republicans don't have a party platform or agenda. Pick your poison, tell me what you do. Everybody go respect the shooter, but the one in front of the gun lives forever.
The one in front of the gun.
I've been hustling all day, this away, that away, through canals and alleyways, just to say, money trees is the perfect place for shade, and that's just how I feel.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Andrew Hartman, who's a professor of history at Illinois State University, who was the founding president of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. His latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars, now out in a second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Andrew Hartman.
Thank you, Ian. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the culture wars are in full bloom, particularly now, with this new round of hysteria from Republicans over vaccine passports. Now, there are two little reality checks we have to do. One is that vaccine passports aren't really passports. They're more like a doctor's certificate. And two, they don't exist. But that's not stopping all this frenzy on Fox News and on Sinclair and on Newsmax, etc. So, what is it about culture wars and the Republicans? Is it because the Republicans don't have a platform? They literally don't stand for anything. So this is the way that they whip up and divert and distract their base?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's been rather, not surprising, but rather discouraging that the pandemic itself has become the response to and solutions to the pandemic have become wrapped up in these, in this 50 years culture war. And this is just another example of that. And I think that, you know, the outrage machine is in full force because, as you mentioned, the Republicans are looking for something to distract people from the fact that, well, I would argue the Biden administration is putting forth some fairly bold legislation that is popular even among some conservatives when it comes to, for example, infrastructure, doing things that Trump had promised but had never achieved. And so, yeah, I would imagine that this is just another sort of example of whipping up a frenzy. I think the vaccine passport issue will go away quickly. I'd imagine because people are going to learn very quickly that if they want to experience these freedoms that they've been pining after, that the easiest way to do that is, in fact, to get vaccinated.
Well, some of the hyperbole, though, it may be going away, but it's, I don't know that it's reached a peak yet. Representative Madison Cawthorn, this sort of young Republican that everybody seems to think is a rising star, he said that the passport proposals, quote, smack of 1940s Nazi Germanism, and that Biden, quote, shares more commonalities with Leninism than liberalism. So, I don't know. I mean, it'd be great if you actually had a contest of ideas between Democrats and Republicans instead of this ridiculous stuff. But I guess it works, right? I mean, they're doing it because it works.
I think, yeah, it does work to some degree. It definitely keeps a certain population of Americans engaged and sort of angry at Democratic leadership. It also allows people to distinguish, I guess, their version of what it means to be an American from versions that they think smack of Well, in this case, you know, the extreme examples of fascism or communism, but maybe more pertinent would be just Europe in general, which is almost undoubtedly going to require people to show proof of vaccines before travel throughout Europe is going to resume freely. So it definitely is a way to sort of, for conservative politicians, conservative intellectuals, if you want to call them that, to distinguish themselves between those things that they think are un-American and sort of to call attention to the fact that we believe in quote-unquote liberty.
So, unfortunately, though, these culture wars do create real damage in legislation, for example, in the state of Arkansas, because of this frenzy that the Republicans have had for some time over transgender bathrooms and stuff like that, and transgender sports that somehow, you know, because a boy could be changed into a girl, therefore it's unfair competition. I mean, they're grasping at straws, but they did some real damage just recently in Arkansas. The governor tried to veto it, but the legislature overrode the veto. They're literally cutting off medication for kids in that transition period. And it, of course, is extremedly dangerous for their health. And they've outlawed a medicine on completely spurious grounds. So there's real damage being done.
Oh, I think without a doubt. And this has long been the case. So a lot of people who, I guess, like us, are in a position in which perhaps we don't feel the culture wars damaging ourselves in our daily lives might look at the culture wars as this sort of ongoing shouting match that is more about appearances and more about outrage than it is about real consequences. But I think they've always had very real consequences in many ways. And for that reason, it's one of the reasons why the culture wars have persisted since the current phase of the American culture wars has persisted, I would argue, since at least the late 1960s. And that's because many people see the issues as vital, as existential even, and that this then gets played out in policies that can be quite serious, as you mentioned. And so like politicians, on the one hand, use the culture wars oftentimes opportunistically, but the consequences can be very real.
So when you refer to it as the outrage machine, the machinery of the outrage machine are Fox, Sinclair, Newsmax, and OAN, I guess. I mean, that's pretty clear that is what they drive up their ratings with, right? Rather than report on and try and analyze what's actually happening with our government and with our politics. They just seize on things that get their audience worked up. So
indeed,
I take it that that's what's at the heart of the outrage machine.
Yes, and increasingly so. I think that as media has increasingly become segmented over the past 30 or 40 years, now more so than ever with, you know, the internet and social media, extremism in terms of news making or news telling, whatever you want to call it, is the ticket to driving up audience share. And I mean, this is true across the board, I would argue. I think the reason why Trump emerged as a successful presidential candidate had a lot to do with the fact that he drove up ratings, not just on the conservative side, but on the liberal side, because the outrage machine is almost universal. It just depends on what you're outraged about. But it's almost, you know, I consider the right-wing outrage machine, Fox News, Newsmax, et cetera, OAN, almost a form of, it's almost generational as well. And Fox News in particular almost seems like elder abuse. There are so many senior citizen Americans who seem to spend a lot of time attached to these media outlets. And we're just witnessing more and more people with really warped senses of realities thanks to these outrage machines.
Well, I guess you could say that the latest outrage, which is these mythical vaccine passports that they're going on about, have they become the new masks?
Yeah, I guess that's the case. It's an easier, I guess, a just so story, and that is that we should be free to live and die and apparently kill other people. Not that the right would interpret it as such, but that seems to be the case. And so, you know, we should be free to not wear a seatbelt. We should be free to not wear a mask. We should be free to not get vaccinated. Consequences for ourselves and others be damned. And so when a governor or a president sort of tries to intervene and make policies that to many of us seem quite rational and reasonable in order to save lives and in order for us to have a more normal post-pandemic existence, these things become sort of impingements on liberty. And this is also an old story in American history. So it's not as absurd as it might sound. It is really rooted in the sort of fear of the state that goes back to the beginnings of the United States, but it really picked up steam after the 1930s and FDR and the New Deal.
So what are the roots, though, of this fear of the government? I mean, the country was started out religious fanatics, and then you had, of course, the American Revolution against a foreign power, a colonial power. And I'd just like to get some clarity on that. What are the roots of anti-government kind of resistance in this country? Because the initial resistance and revolution was against the British.
Yeah, so you could look to that. I would also say that you say religious extremism, that's certainly a part of it. I would say the religious diversity in America from the get-go had all these different sects of Christianity that did not wish for the state or the government to intervene in their affairs, which they defined in very religious terms. And so, in fact, it's the freedom of religion that people had, freedom of religious expression that people have had in the United States has in fact created a sort of anti-statism. I would say that it also goes back to our frontier roots. And so a lot of people who moved west from the very beginning, the thing that seemed to stand in their way other than the indigenous population was a state which was worried about sort of rogue settlers, and that has persisted well into the 20th and 21st century because, like, for example, out west, where a lot of this sort of anti-statist, what you might call libertarianism, exists, out west, the biggest landholder is the state. And so people who are in any way involved in the extractive industries or ranching or landowning, they see the state as the enemy. And so there's several sort of roots that sort of funnel together to create more anti-statism in the United States than a lot of other nations in the world.
Well, certainly the frontier days, one of the aspects of the frontier, of course, were the snake oil salesmen. And that is the component that I find extraordinary, because I think, you know, the Republican Party, these professional politicians are basically just a bunch of salesmen, you know, selling the agenda of the oligarchs, but wrapping it up in quasi-populist terms. But in terms of snake oil, you could not have a more ridiculous, corrupt, incompetent, criminal buffoon than Donald Trump. I mean, it's extraordinary that this man has become president of the United States and was able to do one term and do a lot of damage and is now controlling the Republican Party. So what is it? You know, you can go back to some of the great writing of Herman Melville. His book, The Confidence Man, really describes this whole landscape. So why is that in our DNA? Why are we susceptible to these obviously greedy evangelicals who are shaking people down in these mega churches for money, for delivering whatever? I mean, I can't for the life of me understand what spiritual good they do. And then on top of that, you've got, in our politics, you know, somebody like a Donald Trump could take over and get elected. And he's still a presence here. and there's still, what, 30% of the country adore him. They have no idea that he's a criminal and possibly a traitor.
Yeah, that's the, I guess, the billion-dollar question. I think a lot of it is rooted in the same historical trajectory as anti-statism, in the sense that people don't, a lot of Americans don't trust the sort of regular channels of authority, and so they seek answers outside the regular channels, and that's where the snake oilsmen, as you call them, really sort of flourish, and that's where somebody like Donald Trump, who can paint himself, who's like the ultimate insider in many ways, but who can paint himself as an outsider, that's where people like Trump can flourish, on the margins amongst people who feel like they've been victimized. We can debate the degree to which they have been. Many have not, of course, been victimized, but they don't trust the regular channels of authority. They don't trust intellectuals. They don't trust the media. They don't trust, I guess, anything that would smack of what they would call the liberal elite, which has been a bugaboo of the right really since the 1950s and 60s. And so they, you know, but they still are authority-seeking individuals. And so they find their authority outside the regular channels in these con man like Donald Trump.
Well, just in closing here, will there be any kind of end to this culture wars? What could possibly end this fraudulent battle? Because it's a battle between, you know, fiction and reality, and I just don't know how fiction can continue to win.
Well, I think that if you look at American history, times of cultural consensus when there weren't culture wars, and there haven't been that many actually, but those times tend to be times when there's some sort of national or international crisis. The 1930s saw less of the culture wars because people, generally speaking, were more focused on solving the problems, were more focused on their own economic woes, or people were focused on solving the problems of the Depression. World War II, same thing, an international crisis, there's an external enemy. The early Cold War, to some degree, the same thing. So I hate to say it because I don't relish the idea of us having an external enemy or there being a crisis large enough for the culture wars to go away or sort of go beneath to simmer. But and if you look at American history, it tends to be that we just fight amongst ourselves pretty vehemently over what it means to be an American and whether or not we should sort of have progress or not, unless we can sort of rally around the flag in some fashion.
Well, Dr. Andrew Hartman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Hartman, who's a professor of history at Illinois State University, who was the founding president of the Society of U.S. Intellectual History. And his latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars, now out in a second edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay